sahanavavatu, sahanam punaktu, sahaviryam karavavahai, tejasvinavatitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. I'm going to teach us this and talk a bit about it first, and then I want to teach us this. The four Vedas in India, there's four Vedas, the Rig, the Sama, the Yajus, and then the Atharva Veda. And each Veda has, at the end of it, several, maybe two, three, four Upanishads. And depending upon the Veda that the Upanishad belongs to, there'll be a Shantipata, which is the recitation of the all of these different prayers, like Sahanavavatu is one, where they all end with Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. And so these Shantipatas, or sometimes translated in English as peace invocations, really are prayers to remove all obstructions that might be there to stop us from gaining this knowledge, from as much as having a healthy body, having, you know, enough money, they'll say enough cattle, so that you're not stressed in that way. You know, good health, that your sense organs are all working properly, that your mind is gaining some antakarana shuddhi, all of the things that you need, you pray for that, and that the teacher-student relationship is not an interference in any way to you getting this knowledge. So always before we begin a class, we do a Shantipata. So now for the Mandukya Upanishad, the Mandukya Upanishad is part of the Atharva Veda. And so the Mandukya, Prashna, and the Mundaka all have the same Shantipata, right? Which is the one we're going to learn today. And this is the one that we'll chant before every class. So I wanted to teach it to you, and I thought I'll unfold it to you, and also you can learn a little bit about chanting. And in Swamiji's, actually I didn't make a copy of this, but I didn't think of it, but I will make a copy. This Mundaka also, the Swamiji's Mundaka also has this particular Shantipata because it's part of the Atharva Veda. And he has a beautiful three or four page unfoldment on this, you know, on this particular Shantipata. So I'll make a copy of that. Maybe some of you have the Mundaka. Yeah. So you can look at that. So let's learn this chant, and this is the chant we'll be doing. First, I think I'll translate it for you, and just have you repeat it in English. Okay? I mean, in Sanskrit without the chanting, and then I'll teach you how to chant it. So repeat after me, Bhadram.
Bhadram.
So Om Bhadram.
Om Bhadram.
Karne Bhihi.
Shrinuyama
Devaha. So Om Bhadram Karnebhi Shrinuyama Devaha. Om Bhadram Karnebhi Shrinuyama Devaha. That says Shri. Let me just tell you a couple of things about Sanskrit. One is that a lot of the vowels are like our vowels, but they will have two lengths, like the will be ah. Well, is one matra, ah is two. E, oo. But then r is an R sound that's a vowel. Like if you say Krishna, that's K-R-S-N-A. Kr. So you'll see that in your transliteration, there's just an R with a dot under it, right? So you're going to have to do this since you don't know Sanskrit really, or even the transliteration. Just try to repeat to the best of your ability, okay? So let me do this first line. Om Bhadram. Bhadram means that which is auspicious, that which is a blessing for you. So Karne Bihi. means by my ears, by the ears, karne bihi. Srinuyama means may we hear. It's an imperative. May we hear with our ears that which is badram, that which is auspicious. So badram karne bihi Srinuyama devaha. Devaha is a vocative case, and it's addressing all of the devatas, all of the gods. In all of the different devatas in the creation. So, O devas, may we hear what is auspicious with our ears. Okay. So, Om Badram Karane. And when we actually chant this, there's going to be something called Sandhi rules, where some of the sounds will change. So, it'll be Om Badram Karane Bishrinyama Devaha. But we'll repeat that. I'll teach it to you. Let's do the next one. Next one is Badram Pashema Akshabihi Yajatraha. So here it means Badram auspicious, Pashema, may we see. Then Akshabihi, you see Akshabir, right? It's groundbreaking Sunday for you. Badram Pashema Akshabir Yajatraha. O Yajatras. The Yajatras are devatas. They're devatas who will bless you when you beseech them, when you're singing to them, singing their praises, doing rituals to them, imploring them and praising them. They will bless you. They will give you blessings. It's a particular type of devata. So we're beseeching those Yajatras, and it says, may we see with our eyes, Akshabihi. It can stand for all the sense organs. May we see with our eyes what is auspicious, badram, okay? Then it says, stirair angais. It's actually stirahi angahi. I'm saying some of you have a little Sanskrit, so if you understand what I'm saying, good, and if you don't, just let it go by. Stirair angais is stirahi angahi. Stirahi means firm, strong. Angahi means limbs, with strong limbs. With strong limbs, tushtuvagum means praising. We're praising you, worshiping to the Bhagawan, to the gods, worshiping you with strong, healthy limbs, and also tanubihi, with strong bodies and strong limbs, strong organs, worshiping you, tushtuvagum saha. Vyashema, we engage devahitam, we engage in that which is devahitam. Devahitam means that which pleases the gods, that which follows dharma. So when we say that which is pleasing to all of the devas, that which is beneficial to all of the devas, it means that which is going along with the divine order, with Ishwara's order. So may we engage in that which is devahitam, that which brings pleasure to the gods, that which is good for the gods, for the devas. Yadayuhu. Ayus means long life. So it says, the idea is this. May we, singing the praises of the devas, of all of you, of all of the devas, with strong body and strong limbs, may we live ayus, a long life. May there be a long life, with which we do what is pleasing to the gods. It means we follow dharma. So that's a prayer that we're asking. We're asking for a lot of things. May we have a really long life with a very healthy body, with a healthy body and healthy limbs, and may we. What are we going? May we do with that healthy body, healthy limbs, and long life? May we do dharma? May all of our behavior, may all of our actions be something which is devahitam, something which is pleasing to the gods, which is a blessing, which is beneficial, which is helpful to the gods. Then, swastina indro vridashravaha. At the very end of this, there's this verb, dadatu, at the very end, before the shantis, dadatu. It means may he give. And so all of these are going to take that verb. So it says, Swasti Naha Indraha Vriddeshravaha. May Indra, who's really the lord of all of the different devatas, okay? So may Indra, who is Vriddeshravaha, whose fame goes on increasing. Indra is known throughout all of the different lokas. His fame goes on increasing. Naha, to us, may he give swasti. May he bless us. May he give what is beneficial and helpful to us. So swasti naha indraha vriddeshravaha. And then it says swasti, and the dhatu is understood. Naha, swasti is that which is a blessing. Naha, to us. Pusha. Pusha is the name for the sun. And it has the meaning of nourisher, the one who is nourishing. So the sun which is nourishing, and the sun who is also known as Vishwavedaha, the sun who knows everything. Because the sun, you know, often stands for Brahman, for consciousness, the one that lights up everything. So here the sun, whatever comes into its purview is lit up. So he's Vishwavedaha. Vishwa means everything. So the one for the one who has all knowledge. So may Pusha, the devata of the sun, who is Vishwavedaha, who has all knowledge, may he give us swasti, may he bless us with the swasti, with those blessings, what is beneficial. Auspiciousness, Swamiji uses. This is Swamiji's translation from the Mundaka. Then swasti nastarkshaha arishtanemihi. Tarkshaha is another name for Garuda. And Garuda is the one that flies through the sky. He's famous in the Ramayana. So for Garuda, who flies through the sky without any type of obstruction, so that arishtanemihi is the one who removes and goes through the sky without any obstruction at all. So he's often prayed to also as like Ganesha, as one who will remove obstructions, free you from any obstructions. So then they say, so may Garuda Tarkshaha, who moves through the world, moves through life without any obstruction, you know, may he give us swasti, may he bless us. And then finally it says, swasti naha brihaspatihi dadatu. May Brihaspati, is considered the he's considered, as Swamiji says, the protector of the intellect, but he's also the teacher. He's like the first teacher. He's the teacher of somebody who's important. Let me just look that up. I forget who he is. It's not somebody that we run across all the time, so I don't remember. I know, just look it up. I don't remember right now. Oh, yeah. Brihaspati, so may Brihaspati do, this is at Swamiji, may Brihaspati do good to us. Brihaspati is the teacher of Indra. He's the presiding deity of the intellect. There's also his name, another name for him is Vakpati. Vakpati means the one who's the lord of speech. Vak means speech. The lord and master of speech. So the one who has control over, you know, and also the one who has control and mastery over speech, but also just the lord of speech, the lord of the intellect. So may Brihaspati also protect us, that Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. And when we say the three Shantis, the first one, or you can say it in any order, the first one, Adi Daivika. Adi Daivika Shantihi means that Shanti, may there be peace in reference to all of the things that we have no control over, like for instance earthquakes and thunderstorms and natural disasters, that there's nothing that we can do about them at all. It's all daivam, it's all fate. So adi daivikam, so may there be shanti in reference to all of the natural disasters or things that could bring harm to us. May those all become peaceful. And then adi bhautika are the things other than that are located in my body, like that can bring problems to me, people, other people, or animals, or creatures, or things that I have some control over, you know, Adibhautika. The next, the last one is Adhyatmika. Adhyatmika means my own self. like my body can cause problems for me. Or my mind, my unconscious, my sense organs, the things that are located in the body. May all of those problems also become quiet, become non-problematic. So every time we say this, Om Shanti, 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 that's what we're saying. We're evoking the gods, yeah, and all beings out here that could be have some hostility or some problem with, and also my own body, mind, and sense organs. Okay? So, now look at this chant, and I want you to look at the, just take the top line, and notice that there are some horizontal lines under, do you see that? See the horizontal lines? There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 horizontal line, little horizontal lines on the first line. And then do you see above there's vertical lines, 1, 2, 3, 4 vertical lines? These represent notes. So the first, the horizontal line on the bottom is the low note. It's called anudata. When there's no marking, that's the middle note. It's called udata. When there's a vertical, it's called swarita, and that's the high note. So there's three notes. And then there's not any of these here. Oh, there's one, you see on the second line where there's two vertical lines? That's going to be, it's called swarita, it's going to be two. It's dirgha swarita. I'll teach you that when we get to it. So if I'm gonna just chant right now this, just this first sentence here that's marked by the danda, by the vertical line that breaks these into sections. And just look at how these lines, how you interact with these lines in terms of notes. Om Om Bhadram Karne Bishrinuyama Devaha. Om Bhadram Karne Bishrinuyama Devaha. So repeat after me now. Om Bhadram. Just one. Just a little bit. And you see that M with a dot on top, it's going to change because of Sunday, so you have to do it as I say it, right? So that M with a dot, that ma with a dot, will have different sounds, okay? Do you see that where it says Bhadram? Okay. Yeah. So this is going to be Om Bhadram Karne Bis. Om Bhadram Karne Bis. Om Bhadram Karne Bis. Om Bhadram Karne Bis. Next one. Shrinuyama Devaha. Shrinuyama Devaha. You see in the transliteration that Karne Bis, that's going to change because of Sunday, but at the end you see Devaha, that H with a dot under it. That's going to be aspirated. So it's going to be like Devaha. Devaha. So just repeat after me and you'll certainly, it'll make you all want to learn Sanskrit, so it's good.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but could you say, you said because of Sunday?
Sunday. Sunday. S-A-N-D-H-I. Not because it's Sunday.
Not Tuesday.
Tomorrow we pronounce it differently.
Okay, so repeat after me. Om, Om, Bhadram Karne Bis. Om Bhadram Karne Bis. Shrinuyama Devaha. Shrinuyama Devaha. Om Bhadram Karne Bis. Shrinuyama Devaha. Om Bhadram Karne Bis. Shrinuyama Devaha. Together. Om Bhadram Karne Bis. Shrinuyama Devaha. Then. Bhadram Pashe Ma. Bhadram Pashe Ma. Bhadram Pashe Ma. Kshabirya. Well, this is hard because it's all. So we go like this. Pashe Ma.
Pashe Ma.
Pashe Ma.
Pashe Ma.
Then Kshabir.
Kshabir.
Yajatraha.
Yajatraha.
yajatraha
yajatraha
padram pashe makshabir padram pashe makshabir yajatraha yajatraha Bhadram pashe makshabir yajatraha Bhadram pashe makshabir yajatraha Then stirai rangai e stirai rangai e. Now that two lines up there, the two verticals, instead of just being one sound, it's going to be two. So it'd be, the first one would be stirai rangai hi. Stirai rangai hi. Stirai rangai hi. So let me chant this for a minute by myself. So so follow along till I get to that place. Om Bhadram Karne Vishnu Yama Devaha Bhadram Pashe Makshabhir Yajatraha Stirai rangai ishtu. Yeah, so we do like this. Stirai rangai e. Say that. Stirai rangai ishtu. Stushtu. Stushtu. Vagum. Sastanu bihi. Sastanu. Go like this. Sastanu. Oh no, that's wrong. Sastanu, sastanu bihi, sastanu bihi, sastanu bihi, stirai rangai istushtu vagum, stirai rangai istushtu vagum, sastanu bihi, sastanu bihi, vyashema, devahitam, devahitam, yadayuhu, yadayuhu, vyashema devahitam, vyashema devahitam, vyashema devahitam, yadayuhu, swastina indro, swastina indro, vriddashravaha, vriddashravaha, swastina indro, vriddashravaha, swastina indro, vriddashravaha, swastina, swastina, pusha, swastina, pusha, swastina, pusha, Vishwavedaha, Vishwavedaha, swastinath pusha, Vishwavedaha, swastinath pusha, Vishwavedaha, swastinastarksho, 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 Arishtanemihi, Arishtanemihi, Swastinastarksho, Arishtanemihi, Swastinastarksho, Arishtanemihi, Swastino, Swastino, Brihaspatir, Brihaspatir, Tadhatu, Tadhatu, Swastino,
Swastino,
Brihaspatir Dadhatu, Brihaspatir Dadhatu, Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi, Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Do you see the H, after the Shanti, there's an H with a dot. That's called a Visarga, and it aspirates the final vowel, so you would go, but then there's a Sandhi rule, so that Visarga is going to take the sh sound of the following letter. So it's not shanti, shanti, shanti. It's shantish. So good. Om shantish. Yeah. Because some people just say om shanti, shanti, shanti. That's not right. Because that Visarga has to take a half sha. So it goes, Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Do you hear that?
Like two S's.
Yeah, it's a double, it's like a conjugate consonant of two shas. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi. So we're going to chant this every day. every time before class. So what I'm going to do is on the website, I have, you know, Swami Vagishananda, who I always use as kind of the, he's very good. So I'm going to put his rendition of this on the website along with this so that you can practice. And then we'll just chant it together. I'll chant the first line, you repeat. I'll chant the second one, you repeat, until we've done it for several weeks, and then we'll just chant the whole thing together. But you can practice it. So I'm going to chant this now. You can follow along if you want, and we'll do this now as the in prayer instead of Sahanagata too. We'll be doing this. Om Badram Karne Vishnuyama Devaha Badram Pashe Makshabhirya Jatraha Stirairangai Istushtuvagum Sastanubihi Vyashema Devahitan Yadayuhu Swastina Indro Vridashravaha Swastina Pusha Vishwavedaha Swastina Starksho Arishtanemihi Swastino Brahaspatir Tathatu Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Okay. Okay, I'll give a little bit of an introduction to this and then we'll get to the verse. I'm going to start talking about teaching this. Sound is garbled. Mm. I'm sorry, Joel. It shouldn't be garbled.
Sanskrit.
It was Sanskrit.
It's just our bad chant.
Hi, Shri Louise.
No. The Shantipati. We're doing Dharma to please the Devatas.
Well, sometimes with Devahitam, really, Hitam means that which is beneficial to the gods, beneficial to you. Like, for instance, when we talk about Vaktapas, Vaktapas is one of the great discipline of speech. And what Vaktapas is that your words should be satyam, they should be true, but they should also be hitam. They should be useful, they should be beneficial. And then they should also be preem, pleasing. Unless you're a parent or a teacher. So hitam really means that which is pleasing or beneficial to the gods. But what is really meant by that? Swamiji said, may our actions be pleasing to the gods. That's the idea. Yeah. So let me start. We won't have satsang right now. And Swamiji is talking about the Mandukya. There's a quote, I can't remember it in Sanskrit, but the quote was something like this. I'll get the Sanskrit for it because it's nice. You know, the Mandukya Upanishad is usually kind of the last Upanishad that's taught often. You know, you go through teaching all of the different Upanishads, there's a certain order, traditional order, that they're taught in the Mandukya. It usually comes last. And then there's this little phrase that is often quoted in the tradition that for the mumukshus, for those who are desiring liberation, the Mandukya is enough. It's alam. The Mandukya Upanishad is alam. It's enough. And so Swamiji, in talking, when he quoted that particular verse and talked about it in terms of the nature of the Upanishads and the teaching methodologies involved for really teaching an Upanishad. Upanishad isn't just something to be read or studied. It's actually not that there's anything wrong with reading or studying it, but to really understand it, it has to be taught by somebody who has been taught. So that's what we call the sampradaya. The guru has taught the sisha then teaches their sishas, like that, goes on like that. And what really is taught is the methodology for really revealing the nature of reality, the nature of yourself. You know? And revealing the nature of yourself is a lot different than having an intellectual understanding of it. It requires a actual recognition, an actual seeing of it, you know, where the knowledge that's being unfolded to you becomes what we call aproksha. Aproksha means it becomes direct and immediate, where you actually see what is being said, you recognize it. Like, for instance, if I use my eyes to see that painting there, that's immediate direct knowledge. Right? It's not indirect. You know, it's something that comes right into my sphere, so I'm experiencing it. As opposed to somebody giving me a lecture on the painting and describing it, all of that, that's indirect knowledge. So we use our sense organs to gain direct immediate knowledge for objects that can be objectified by us. Even the mind, in terms of emotions or spiritual states of, you know, that require vrittis, thought modifications, it's called sakshibhasya, because awareness illumines those, they become direct and immediately known. Like through the sense organs, all of this becomes direct, immediately known. And so such knowledge, direct, immediate knowledge of this sort, requires, you know, a means of knowledge that is capable of giving that. Now, here, in terms of self-knowledge, would we be wanting, in terms of knowledge, to have direct knowledge or indirect knowledge? When we're talking about indirect knowledge, it would be somebody giving a lecture on the nature of the self as revealed in the Upanishads. And so then you would at least know, if you were to attend such a lecture, what the subject matter of the Upanishads were, you know, and you'd know something about them, and you would know that they say that the self is infinite and non-dual and all of that, and you may or may not be interested in it. But you may or may not be interested in it. You know, your interest, it would depend really on what we call your adhikaritvam, how much you've assimilated your experience here, whether that would be of interest to you or not. But it definitely wouldn't be, it wouldn't give you direct knowledge. But the idea of having indirect knowledge of you doesn't really make sense, because you are already immediately present. Right? Just like when I take pratyeksha or indirect knowledge, when I'm talking about anything that is immediately present to me to experience, it doesn't make sense to talk about that which is right here indirectly. Right? Because here it is. I have the object and I can see it and experience it. And then you can say all kinds, like for this thing, I'm now experiencing it. I have direct immediate knowledge of it. And then I can learn all kinds of things about this object which I'm experiencing. Okay? And so with my sense perception, I gain this direct immediate knowledge for whatever is in the sphere of the sense organs. See? And then I can learn more and more about this thing that is immediately present to me. Now, yourself, and in fact reality, this totality of experience, is immediately present. It's not like the self, what we call the self, is somewhere else. Because when we say the self, we're talking about your immediate self-experience as a conscious, existent being. That isn't hypothetical. It's not theoretical. We're talking about the awareful being, the consciousness, the being that is actually makes you, you. Now, what I mean by that is, you may have it all mixed up, maybe all mixed up, but nevertheless, your ahankara, the I thought, you know, the I or the me thought, is landing on you, the conscious being. Even if it loads onto you, you know, the subject, the by subject I mean the conscious being who is there present to all experience that you have, to all moods that you have, all emotions that you have, all states of experience that you have, all perceptions that you have, I am the one who's having these. So this conscious being, you know, is the one who is present to every situation that comes into my consciousness. Right? If it doesn't come into my consciousness, then it's a non-issue. But I am there for every experience that comes into my consciousness. I'm the center of it. Now, the problem is that this central me, you know, is there and is what we call aparoksha. It's direct, immediate knowledge for all of us, whether you have self-knowledge or not. Your self-experience is immediate, as I am, I exist. And now, probably just everything I said, you'll say, oh, yes, yes, that's true. I'm the one present to my experience. I'm here, you know. Well, that you can even say that, that means that you are here, that you have the self-experience of your being. Now, the problem is that this self-experience of you, right, is on the knowledge you have, the experiential knowledge you have, is very general. It's just, I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being. But then if I were to push you a little bit, you wouldn't probably, unless you have self-knowledge, you wouldn't really know what to say. Like, if I were to say, you are a conscious being because you have a body. Your body is what gives you beingness and consciousness. Or you might say, you know, well, no, I think that I'm a soul that has taken this body, and that's what gives this body consciousness. I'm a transmigrating soul. Yeah. And then I could say, well, are you the conscious being, the conscious being, then are you subject to birth and death? Well, I don't really know. If I'm this body, I'm subject to birth and death. If I'm not the body, then a soul, then maybe I'm not subject to the death of the body. I don't know. I know that I'm a conscious being. Do you know if the conscious being, this conscious being that you are, is it different from the conscious being that I am? I would think so, because there's different bodies. But actually, now that you mention it, you know, I don't necessarily know. So I don't know. I know conscious being, me. That's aparoksha, that's immediate and direct. But what I am, what my limitations are, I don't know. You know. If I'm born or die, I don't know. If I survive the death of the body, I don't really know. If I'm the same in all beings, like the Upanishads say, I really don't know how that could be. You know, I don't know. But I know that I am and I exist. So that self is immediate, directly present. The problem is not that. It's like, with my eyes, I have this thing here. I see this, and now I can learn all about it. But my eyes are giving me the knowledge of it. Now, I don't need my eyes to give me the knowledge of me in terms of my experiential presence. But if I start to wonder who I am, and if I survive death, and what's the relationship between me and you and the Lord, if there is one, then I need some knowledge. But to gain that knowledge, I need a pramana. I need a means of knowledge to help me recognize that, because you already are recognized in terms of experience. But you don't know, you know who you are, but you don't know who you are. Right? I know I am and I exist, but I don't know anything about that in reference to this creation, to this body, mind, sense, organs. I have no idea. In reference to Ishvara, I don't know. And so how am I going to know that? What would be the means of knowledge to know that? Because all of the means of knowledge I have, like are really based on sense perception. The means of knowledge I have to know things are based upon my sense organs and based upon a subject-object relationship. I know my means of knowledge allow me to know things which I can objectify. Even when we get into indirect knowledge like inference, like I see smoke on the hill, therefore there's a fire, or presumption, I see, you know, it's all wet outside, but it's sunny, but so it must have rained out. It must have rained last night. I know that, because there's an invariable concomitance there. And so I have all these means of knowledge, but they all exist for things that I can objectify. So how to know myself, who I am? I know me, but how do I know what me is? That's the problem. And so in the Vedic tradition, the Upanishads deal with exactly this situation. The Upanishads are considered a pramana, a means of knowledge for the direct recognition of the nature of myself and the relationship of this self, this conscious being, that is aproksha, means immediately present, the relationship of this me to the body-mind sense organs, jiva, to the world, the jagat, and to Ishvara, the Lord. It's not just knowing the nature of conscious being. We already know the nature of conscious being. I'm a conscious being. But we have no idea of the relationship of conscious being to my experience that includes my body, my mind, my sense organs, the I thought, the world of percept that I perceive, the dream state, the waking state, the whole infinite creation, Ishvara, all of this we don't know. And so the Upanishads are a means of knowledge for that. Now, all of the Upanishads rely on two major, there's different prakriyas, but two major what we call prakriyas. A prakriya is a teaching methodology, right? And so in order for this knowledge to be unfolded, given to a student, there are teaching methodologies that, there's several of them, but there's two major ones that are adopted by most Upanishads, all the Upanishads really. And the two that are the most important, let me put it like this, there's two things that have to happen. The prakriyas, the teaching methodologies, have to accomplish two things, basically. The first is that your self, the conscious being that you are, that we call the pratyek atma. The pratyek atma means the self which is innermost. Pratyek means innermost, inner. Yeah. So we in English we say pratyek atma is the innermost self. What we mean by that innermost self means the one that cannot be objectified. If I can objectify, something I can objectify, then there's the subject and the object. I've been able to do a subject-object differentiation. Right, like with my sense organs, I don't make this mistake, there's no problem. I see the painting, I don't take myself to be the painting. Because I've objectified it. So anything external to the body that I can objectify, I'm quite very clear that I, the subject, am differentiated there from the object. Okay? But what has to happen now is the conscious being that you are, that is at the bottom rung, the conscious being that can't be objectified, so that there is conscious being illumining, like the mind, conscious being illumining the sense organs, conscious being illumining the I thought. But in the end, you can't have conscious being illumining conscious being, because there's no subject-object. Conscious being is conscious being. There's not two. There's not a conscious being, consciousness, which is illumining consciousness as though it's something different. And so you have to, this type of a prakriya is, there's ones called Drik Drisha Viveka. That's a prakriya. It's a teaching methodology that goes through step by step by step that allows you to differentiate the innermost self from all of the things that you had taken it to be that are actually things that are objectified that actually belong to the universe. Another one is called Panchakosha Viveka. That's the discrimination between the same seer seen, But using the five, using the five koshas, like the physical body, and then the prana, and then the mind, the manas, then the buddhi, the intellect, then the anandamaya kosha, the causal body. So these koshas, we use them to differentiate conscious being from these because they're objectifiable. That's a panchakosha viveka. It's a prakriya. It's a teaching methodology that we have to take the student step by step by step to the recognition, right, of myself. So those two, one very commonly used, the panchakosha viveka is very commonly used in Taittiriya Upanishad. In the Mandukya Upanishad, the one that is used to accomplish this is called the Avastatraya. The whole thing is Avastatraya Sakshi, where I recognize myself as the witness, as the Sakshi, the consciousness, of the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state, where I'm differentiating myself, conscious being, from these states, which all three of which negate each other. So we're going to be going through this particular prakriya, the Avastha Traya Sakshi. Avastha, the word Avastha means a state of experience, Avastha. Traya means a group of three. The Avastha Traya, the three states of experience, waking, dream, deep sleep, for the jiva, for the individual. When waking state, we mean when we're awake to our sense organs. So our sense organs, it's called bahishpragnaha. The consciousness is as though pouring outside. You know, my consciousness is pouring outside through my sense organs, as though like rays are coming out through my sense organs, so that I'm aware of this external world. I'm perceiving what is outside. That's the waking state. In the dream state, the sense organs are not in operation. The matter for the dream state can be what the sense organs had previously perceived. But in the dream state, there is the sense organs are not functioning. And so it's all the subtle body in the dream state. And then in the waking state, in the deep sleep state, there is no dream or waking. There's no duality being experienced in the deep sleep state. So every jiva is going through these three states of experience, waking, dream, deep sleep. And I can say that I, the one who is the waker, is the one who is the dreamer, is the one who is the deep sleeper. And by doing an analysis of these three states of experience and removing what is negated one by the other, I can recognize who is present in all three. And so this is called the Avastatraya Sakshi. It's one that this particular prakriya is one that this Mandukya Upanishad will be using. The other prakriya, which all of the Upanishads have to use, is called the Karyakarana. Karyakarana means cause and effect. And with the Karyakarana, Karya means effect, Karana means cause. With this prakriya, you know, we come to the Satyam Mitya. With this cause-effect prakriya, which resolves into satyam-mitya, where satyam is what is real, mitya is that which depends totally for its being on what is real. Like, for instance, clay pot. Clay is satyam, pot is mitya. There is no pot without the clay. So here, this whole universe resolves into satyam-mitya. Brahman, conscious being, is satyam. The entire manifest duality on every level, and even the unmanifest of maya, that is mitya. Without that satya mitya understanding, there's no advaita. You cannot come to advaita. Because unless all of this dvaita means duality, because all of this duality that we experience is dual. It's not a dvaita. It's not non-dual. It's infinite, infinite dvaita. And so in order for such a thing as advaita to be, all of this has to be like a clay pot. It has to be like the better example, it has to be like the wave ocean, where there are countless waves. That is, if we expand it, there's an infinite number of waves, infinite number of nama rupa, of names and forms. Countless. And all contained in one infinite whole, Ishvara. But really, there's only one water. That's Advaita. There's only one water. So this whole infinite universe has to resolve into one being, one non-dual being, for there to be Advaita. And of course, that one non-dual being has to be me. It must be me, or I am not. If there's one non-dual being, I must be that, because there's nothing else. But not only must I be that, you must be that, the rug must be that, the table must be that, the sky must be that, everything that is must be that. Because that's Advaita. There is nothing that is not that. And so, for that to be real, for that to be the nature of reality, you must have the satya mitya. Satya mitya means that there is something which is, upon which something else totally depends for its being, itself having no being for of its own. Like, that's why clay pot is such a pretty, it's a nice example. Rope snake is another one. Clay pot, rope snake. These are kind of like Vedanta bread and butter. Clay pot, rope snake, wave ocean. To understand the satya-mitya relationship. Because without understanding satya-mitya, there is no such thing as Advaita, the way that Advaita Vedanta defines Advaita, non-duality. Now, non-duality is a buzzword at CIS and California. It's a buzzword, you know. Yeah. The thing is that people mean different things by this word, non-duality. In fact, in one of my classes, is called at CIS, it's called Non-Dual Perspectives in Spiritual Counseling. And one of the first things I do is have everybody in the room write down their definition of non-duality. So we can see that we're all talking about something different. You know? Like, for instance, non-dual. Non-dual can mean, and often just means the interconnectedness of everything. Like, it would be like saying there's only one infinite universe. Everything in this universe is interconnected. It's only one non-dual universe, meaning there's not two universes. There's only one universe, not two. Or there's only one infinite manifestation, not two. See what I mean? But that one infinite universe itself is internally dual. You understand? Like what if I were to say, there's only one universe, but that one universe has many, many parts. Nevertheless, there's only one universe, it's all interconnected. And I could say, and this one infinite universe, it's all interconnected. Not only that, it's not only just interconnected on this level, it's interconnected on a subtle level. On every level, it's interconnected. And so there is only one. But in Advaita Vedanta, we would not say that that is non-dual. For something to be Advaita, three things have to be one and one only. First one is that there can be, you know, there can only be one species. We'll say one set. Like, say, for instance, say if I took a species, cats, you know, there's the species cats. And what if that was the only species there was? All that exists, all that exists are cats. Okay? So there's not dogs or anything else. There's only cats. And so we could say, okay, there's only one. There's only one species. There's not two species. There's only one. But then somebody would come and say, yeah, but that's not non-dual. Because in that species there are many members, and the many members are two or more. That's dual. So on one aspect, it's only one, but within itself, it's dual. So that's not non-dual. That's what Vedanta would say. It's not non-dual. It's one species, you know, like we could say it's one universe, but that universe has many parts. It's not, you know, it's not non-dual. And then we could say, okay, say it's like this. There's one species, cats, and in that species, there's only one cat. So all that exists is one cat. Okay? So it's really non-dual now because we have one species with only one member. And the Advaita would say, no, that's not true because that one member has many parts. So for you to be non-dual, it has to be, you know, one species, one set, with one member, with no parts. So that's non-dual. So this creation, if you were to, you could maybe perhaps prove in whatever I have logic to say, this infinite creation is only one full of one whole filled with infinite interconnected parts. You would say, yeah, okay, we accept one infinite manifestation. Vedanta does accept that as the very nature of creation. It's a manifestation of one. Ishwara is one. On every level, it's only one being which is totally interconnected parts. So we would accept that one infinite creation, but it has many parts. Right? And so that means that one infinite creation with many parts has to be mitya. All of it has to be mitya because many parts is dual. It means the whole infinite creation and everything in it on every level has to be mitya. It has to be dependent for its reality, clay pot, wave, ocean, water. It has to be dependent on it for its reality on one non-dual being. And one non-dual being means it itself has no parts, it has no twins, it's no second thing, right? And it doesn't have another species. Like another species would be, or another set would be, like, okay, there's a one non-dual Brahman, and then over here there's what we call the prakriti. Prakriti means the whole sattva, rajas, tamas as a different existent thing. It's just a different set over here. There's a non-dual Brahman over here and the prakriti over here. But that's dual. We've got prakriti over here, the material cause of the creation, and Brahman over here. That's dual. There can't be that. This prakriti has to come over to Brahman and become mitya so that it has no second thing. So, without going through all of the unfoldment to establish this, which requires this cause-effect relationship to collapse into what we call satya-mitya, this dependent relationship, the vision of Vedanta is not there. Because the vision of Vedanta of the Upanishad is Advaita, is non-dual. And so this karya-karana prakriya is essential for gaining this vision, and the Mandukya Upanishad is the king of the karya-karana. And so the whole Upanishad is sitting in this particular prakriya. You know, it must establish first, in all of these prakriyas, these teaching methodologies, they must first establish the seer seen so that you can recognize and differentiate the conscious being that you are from all of these upadis, all these things that can be objectified. Because once you can differentiate, recognize yourself and differentiate yourself from all of the things that come and go in your experience, then it is that one that is the karana. That one is the satyam, and everything else is going to be shown to be mitya. And if everything else is shown to be mitya, then I am everything else. Because by the very nature of satyam mitya, mitya has no being at all apart from the satyam. So that's what this is all about. And so we'll start on it next week, but I want to tell just a few more things about this. This Upanishad, it's only, I think, 12 verses. It's a very short Upanishad. And it is the Raja for this Karya Karana, so it's a very important Upanishad. But this Upanishad had, prior to Shankara, a Kataka written by Shankara's guru's guru. Shankara's guru was Govindapada. Gaudapada was Govindapada's guru. And so this Kataka, what the Kataka, a Kataka is really, is not a commentary on the Upanishad. It's not a bhasha on the Upanishad. A bhasha is something that, in a very systematic order, defines all of the words and compounds in the Upanishad, in the Mula Mantra, in the Upanishad Mantra, and then we'll take care of any Purvapaksha Siddhanta, any objections. That's what it does. This Kataka is not that. It's in verse form, and what it does is deal with and expand upon what the Upanishad is talking about in verse form. And so that's what this Kataka does. It breaks it into four chapters. The first chapter is called the Agama Prakarana. So four chapters. The Agama Prakarana, Agama means the Vedas. So the first chapter is just expounding upon the mantras of the Upanishad. The next chapter is called the Vaitatya Prakarana. The Vaitatya means mithya. That Prakarana is establishing the mithyatva of the universe, of all duality. The third chapter is called the Advaita Prakarana. The Advaita Prakarana, after establishing the mithya, then establishes the Advaita, the non-duality. The fourth Prakarana is called the Alata Shanti Prakarana. What that does is bring up all of the different darshanas, the different schools of thought that were existing there at Gaudapada's time, and he presents their positions and negates them, establish and strengthen the Advaita. Remember that in the whole teaching methodology, it's the teaching means of knowledge that we use, the sadhana, called the Upayanishta. The first is Shravana. Shravana has to do with understanding what the Upanishad says. Really clearly understanding. So the Agama Prakarana is expanding upon, clarifying, and dealing with what the Upanishad actually says. Then it's establishing the Mithya and the Advaita, in the Vaitatya and the Advaita, and the Advaita Prakarana. But then it also has to do Manana. Manana means to look at all of the other schools, all of the darshana, all of the darshanas, and establish Advaita in reference to that darshana. So it's called Purvapaksha Siddhanta, where you bring up the objections of the other schools of thought, and then do give the Siddhanta, give your explanation. Yeah. So in debate. And so this, the final one, Alata Shanti is bringing to bringing to quietude all of these other schools of thought. The Alata is like when you were a kid, you know, when you had those sparklers? Like if you light a sparkler and then it's dark out and then you go like that and it makes all circles and everything. So that little fire tip is the Alata. So bringing that, you know, you're making all of these movements with a little consciousness up there. You bring it to a resting point. So bring that Alata, that fire, that little firebrand, to a place of stillness, you know, quieting all of these objections. So that's what Gaudapada does in this Kataka. Now, Shankara, this is interesting, I didn't know this, but this is something that Swamiji brought out. There is quite a big bhasha on the verses of the Upanishad that people were attributing to Shankara, but actually what Swamiji was saying, these these commentaries on the verses are not, he doesn't think that they're written by Shankara. He said Shankara only wrote the verses, wrote Bhāṣya's commentaries on the Karika and Gaudapada's Karika out of respect for Gaudapada, because Gaudapada already had expounded on the Upanishad verses. And so Shankara just wrote a commentary on those verses out of respect for his guru's guru. Okay, that's kind of nice. So, okay. So we'll do the start it next week. Verse. Purnamada, Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamudachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vasishate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Harihi Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha, Harihi Om.
Meaning a Bhāṣya is
the I can do the Bhāṣya and the
Bhāṣya means and then
the Vartika and the Vritti
and the
in the Tika. Mm-hmm. I get them confused. Let me tell you the ones I'm pretty sure of. I know the Bhāṣya. The Bhāṣya is a commentary upon the verses of the Upanishad. And that is just what I said. It's breaking down the word meaning so you're clear on what the Upanishad says. And then it'll go into Purvapaksha Siddhanta, bringing up all of the objections, the Purvapaksha and the Siddhanta answering them. That's basically what the Bhāṣya is. That's the job of the Bhāṣya. The Vartika, as I understand it, is a commentary in verse form on the Bhāṣya. That's my understanding. The Karika, my understanding from Swamiji, and I don't have a lot of depth in this, so I'm just telling you what I know, and I think it's right. But I won't get swear to it. The Karika is an independent commentary on the verses. It's not like the Bhāṣya where it's dealing with the verses. It's taking the subject matter of the verses, like here of the Upanishads, and it's writing its own Karika on that subject matter, expanding it and dealing with it. And so in the Agama, Agama means the Veda, so in the Agama Prakarana, he's expanding on the verses, and then he's going further in the other chapters to establish in his own way the subject matter of those verses. So that's a Karika, so that's different. Then there's a Vritti. A Vritti is just a very brief commentary. And the Vritti just really gives the word meaning of the verse, and it doesn't go into Purvapaksha Siddhanta. So the Vritti is like just a little paragraph, really a little paragraph on the verse without any Purvapaksha Siddhanta and any commentary, just making clear the meaning of the verse, breaking the compounds, that kind of stuff. So that's about all of them, isn't it? It's like, oh, and then the Tika. The Tika is a very brief commentary explication on the Bhāṣya. And they're like footnotes. They're footnotes to the Bhāṣya.
So Shankara's Bhāṣya here is on the Karika?
Well, what Swamiji is saying, even though he says that what he mentions, and I'm sure he has his information from somewhere, but also, for these scholars, like Swamiji is he's a scholar. Mm. And once you've read Shankara over and over and everything, he's read everything that Shankara's ever written, you get to know him. And then there's somebody, everybody has their writing style, they have their vocabulary, they have the way that they do things. And then sometimes a lot of things are attributed to Shankara that are not said in any way that Shankara would say. And so what they say is often is that these works, even though attributed to Shankara, were probably written by a later Shankaracharya. Remember that Shankara established 4 mutts, which are learning centers, you know, there's for, to hold the tradition of Advaita. And then each head of each mutt becomes themselves a Shankaracharya. So there's so many Shankaracharyas, right? So this, so sometimes they'll say, this was probably written by a later Shankaracharya. And Swamiji says that about the commentary on the Upanishad mantras themselves. You know, and he says, and he said, if you understand that, then he said, those that commentary is quite confusing. It's not, Shankara is so clear, so precise, and easy to read, the language is so clear. He said, this, the commentary on the mantras is a little confusing. On the Katika, it's clear, and even very clear, very clearly Shankara, and also the introduction is very clearly Shankara. And the introduction itself is talking about the Katika, not about the mantras. So if you go from the introduction, Shankara's introduction, to the verses in the Katika, then it all makes sense. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. We read it all. We do the whole thing, and he did the whole thing also.
So yeah. The verses we see here are not the verses of the Upanishad, but the verses of Shankara's teacher's teacher.
No, it goes like this, just so that you're all clear on this. If you, the first verse, let's see, is on page 7 in this little booklet. And this is the Upanishad 2, and it goes all the way to page 18. So the first 6 verses, like the first half of the Upanishad, are dealt with. And then Gaudapada's Katika starts on page 18. You see that?
Yeah.
And then, so that's now keep going, 1, 2.
I see, so it alternates throughout.
It alternates for the first chapter. It alternates. And it'll always announce when we're going back into the Upanishad. And so then it looks like on page 31, it starts, the Upanishad starts again. Unless I missed it. Yeah, on page 31, the Upanishad starts again. And so we teach it in this order. You know, we'll do the first 6 that are all the Upanishad, and then we'll do, it just moves into Gaudapada's Katika, then we come back to the Upanishad again, then we'll go to Gaudapada's Katika.
And the English prose is Shankara's commentary on the Katika.
Yes, it is. And it's also Shankara's, which may be an Adi Shankara, I mean a later Shankara, not Adi Shankara. That also is just considered as Shankara, but there's some doubt about it.
So there's no real straight bhasha on the Upanishad.
There is. Like, say, like if you look at page 3, these are 2 prayer verses by Shankara on page 3.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's written these prayer verses, which then has been translated, and then he introduces it. You see where it says introduction? On page 4, this is Shankara's introduction to the Agama Prakarana. And then you see where on page 7 there's the first verse, Om Idiyata Rakshanamidam. This verse then has a bhasha. And the second one, they all have bhashas, which is the paragraph underneath the verse. Mm-hmm. The paragraphs underneath the verse.
Well, I think my confusion is that this Shankaracharya, the bhasha is on the Karika, right?
Well, you can just read all of it as Shankara, because it's all attributed to Shankara. I'm just giving you a little tidbit. Okay. The tidbit is this.
Okay.
That it's said that Shankara actually wrote the introduction and then the bhasha, the Bhashyas to Gaudapada's Karika, those verses.
Okay.
And he didn't touch, he didn't write anything for the Upanishad verses.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is something written for the Upanishad verses.
Okay.
We're saying that that is probably from a later Shankaracharya.
Okay.
Which is fine, you know.
Yeah.
Very different style. But it, for Swamiji, it makes a difference. He says if you understand that, then it all makes a lot more sense.
The more the better, you know.
if you're following Shankara, if you read the introduction, his introduction, and then go to the Karika Bhasha, then that works in terms of Shankara. Then take the verse, the Bhasha to the verses as being a Bhasha, but written by somebody else.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's see if John's online. No, he's not here. John Warren did a transcription of Swamiji's 64 or more talks on this. It must have taken Swamiji 4 months to teach this, teaching every day. You know? So he transcribed the whole thing. It's very, very tedious to read through it. It's a lot of words. It's a lot of words to read through, and you have to read through it very carefully and all of that. So I'm reading through that, you know, as best that I can, just so that I could pick out some of the things that are really interesting and pass them on. You're all welcome to get that. I think you should take a look at my copy or Hal's or something before you buy it, because it's, you can buy it from the ashram if you want it. But there's a lot of Sanskrit in it. There's a lot of untranslated Sanskrit in the Bhasha, and so it can be, it's a little bit of an overkill.
Is the Mandukya taught last because it's hard to understand?
No. Well, I think because it's so situated in Advaita, you know, that Advaita, that to really, there's a lot of things you have to take care of in terms of the relationship of the jiva to Ishwara. And then all of that is not negated, it all becomes mithya. But you can't make something become mithya that you don't even know about. Right? And so, like, what if I just say, oh, doesn't matter, you're mithya after all, doesn't make any difference. Ishwara is mithya, the jiva is mithya, your emotions are mithya. So what difference does it make? You know? Bondage is mithya, moksha is a mithya. It says all of this, but if you don't have any knowledge of what they're dismissing, or what it even means to dismiss, it's not even really a dismissal, it's an understanding. Like if I have a clay pot, do I have to dismiss the pot? I'm not dismissing the pot, I'm just recognizing the clay. You know, that's all that's really there, the pot's still there. You know, the wave ocean, there's still all of these relationships. So Brahman, Advaita, Brahman, the non-dual self, doesn't need Vedanta. You know, your being doesn't need Vedanta. You're already totally free. The one who needs it is the jiva that thinks I'm bound and I need to be liberated. And that involves, that process involves a lot of understanding. You know, so don't worry. Even though we're teaching this now, we'll teach it in a way that is useful, not in a way where you go around saying, oh, you're mithya, you're mithya.
why is this...
I'm mithya.
why is this text, this Upanishad, the last to be taught? Or
I don't know. That's just, yes, maybe because it's totally Advaita. I always kind of felt, and some of us used to kind of laugh at school, I mean, when I was at the ashram, that, you know, after you hear the Mandukya, you just don't want to hear anything else. It's over. So I teach a lesson.
You get spoiled.
That's a common way of losing students.
True, though, because I can go through all of them and then start at the beginning again and be just fine.
Yeah.
It's like when that Vidhitatmananda said, you know, never get tired of Vedanta because it's like holding up a mirror. You never get tired of looking at yourself.
That's true.
Yeah. Could you explain what a sundae is?
Yeah. Incense.
Ice cream.
Yeah, yummy. Sounds good to me. In Sanskrit, the script is something that is meant to be very true to what you actually say. So, for instance, if I said, using an example, the word tut. Tut means that, and this is a stock example. Dahati means burns. So if I say that burns, like that wood is burning, that burns. The two words are tut and dahati. But if I say them just talking normally, tut dahati, the da affects the ta. It makes it like say tut dahati. You have to come to a full stop to get the tut. If you just talk like normally, the da will drag the ta into a da position. And so they won't write they won't write tut dahati. They'll write tud dahati. Tud dahati, because that's what you actually say. So sundi means the combining of letters. When letters come connect together, they change. What actually happens in your vocal system changes. And so there are rules for those changes. Letters are going to be affected by another letter, then they'll write the effect that takes place. Those are called sundi rules, and there's a lot of them, but they all make sense.
So it's an oral tradition, then. It's not a written tradition.
Well, it is an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. It is an oral tradition because it's so ancient. But if the Devanagari script came later, they would use the Devanagari script to write what is actually being said. That's the idea. And that's put into rules called sundi rules. Another one, like if I have the word atma, and I have a word like ayam, atma ayam, atma ayam. Right, so the ah and the ah come together. Two vowels, atma ayam. I don't say atma ayam, it's atma ayam. See how they run together? So that has to be written as a long ah, not as ah, ah. So those are sundi rules.
It shows up in the script.
In the script, right. And that's why this is what's confusing for new students until they've learned all these rules. If I'm reading this, like when I was reading, oh my gosh, they don't know these rules because I'm not actually saying what you see here. It's going to be different. You know, because I'm having to pronounce things according to the sundi rules. And if I break it, then it all changes.
So when you see the r sound, it's usually a sundi.
It can be a visarga.
Yeah.
The two dots. Yeah. There's a lot of them. And the thing is, they're so logical that it's intellectually very pleasing as you learn them, you know.
Phonetically very pleasing.
Yes.
It feels like the path of least resistance for the mouth.
Exactly. That's a beautiful way to say it. That's exactly it. Yeah. That's the path of least resistance, what naturally happens.
Yeah.
And they just have the script match what is actually being said. It's very nice. Sanskrit's a wonderful language because it's pleasing in so many ways. It's so logical, and all of the words break up. The words have verbal roots that have a meaning. And so the words contain their meaning. Like vriksha means that which can be felled, and another word for tree, that's the word for tree, that which can be chopped down. Tadu, that which is tree, that which has roots, you know. Tadu is roots, so that which has roots is a tree. So there's so many words, they're all descriptive. It's like the meaning is held in the word. It's just an amazing language.
Do you have another quick question? Might not be quick. It seems in the examples you made earlier, the pot and the clay and the wave and the water are satamitya, but I'm not seeing the satamitya so much in the rope and the snake, more a matter of...
It's a different type of...
perception. So it's still satamitya, but it's more about I'm not seeing.
Yes, well, but in that particular, there are two, what they call drishtantas. There's still two illustrations that we use side by side. when we do the Satyam Mithya for the rope snake, you're seeing that really there's only one material cause there. Right? There's only one. What is actually there is only clay. That's it. And so the pot is totally dependent. So that's a beautiful example for the Satyam Mithya. When we use the rope snake, now in this instance, we're highlighting the nature of Maya. Okay? Because in the rope snake, the rope has three bends and an inch diameter or whatever. You know, say you have a rope line there, it's got three bends, an inch and a half diameter, maybe it has some twigs sticking out. The twigs would be the fangs. So the Maya, you know, is totally dependent on the rope for its being. So the snake is going to have the same three bends, the same diameter, the twigs could be the, whatever is there, is going, is whatever is actually there, is the basis, the truth of the snake. Right? And so the snake has no substance apart from the rope. If I were to remove the rope, I remove the snake. See what I mean? But the snake has no reality of its own. And so now we're still Satyam Mithya, because the snake totally depends on the rope for its being. But the snake is not the rope, right? The snake is, this universe is not, it. This universe of multiplicity has for its being only non-dual Brahman. But non-dual Brahman isn't multifaceted and multicolored and all of this kind of stuff. And so this Maya has to come in. So that's why we use these two examples. One is highlighting that there's only one being, clay. The other is highlighting the Maya of the Mithya. But that Maya has no being apart from the rope. It has no nothing to, there's no way it can exist without the rope.
Well, there has to be something there to mistake.
Well, yeah, but it's more than that. Just from its own standpoint, in terms of the universe, the Brahman and the universe, the Maya, if you were to remove being, which would be the rope in this case, there is no Maya. Because what actually is there is rope. And so the isness of this is the rope. Like, see, in this creation as we're experiencing it right now, the everything in this creation, it is. All of it enjoys being. Okay? But if I analyze all of the things in this creation, there is nothing that enjoys being in and of itself. Because everything in the creation comes into being and goes out of being. It's born and it dies. That means it's bordered by non-being. And so non-being, nothing can come from non-being because nothing's there. Right? And so, but everything enjoys being, even though none of it itself has being. It all has being, but the being that it has is the substantive of the entire creation. It's not something which any given object has in and of itself. You can say, like, everything comes into being and goes out of being. Being doesn't come into being or go out of being. So being is what is actually here. The being, the amness, the isness. Amness, isness, arness. These are all just verbal forms of being itself. So you have being, your isness, your amness, you know. And that's invariable. That's always exactly the same. But all of your experiences are coming into and going out of that. But your amness, your being, is it coming and going. It's stable. And that amness then, because of duality and this all the superimposition, we've taken being and divided it into amness, isness, and arness. I am, you are, it is. As though it belongs to these things, you know. As though there's difference. Your amness is different from my amness, is different from this isness. But actually, it's exactly the same. It's the one thing, not objectifiable. So that's all. But that takes a lot of a lot of teaching.
Well, I was getting hung up on the fact that the pot exists. The snake is non-existent.
Yeah, but it's still experienced, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. 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 Oh, that's helpful. Thank you. Yeah.
Well, I should call it tonight.